That wonderful hymn that we've just sung together was written by Glenda Shales. Many of you, some of you may know her. She's from our neck of the woods down in Houston, worships with the Kleinwood congregation. Actually, her daughter, Joella Gates, worships with us at Decker Prairie. So I get to see Glenda from time to time. She is such a talented hymn writer. It was my privilege when I preached in Baytown for 12 years, to have lunch on Tuesdays with her dad, Glenn Barnhart. What a great, meek soul he was, who labored many years in preaching the gospel. And you understand where the faith of Glenda and Joella comes from. And so I love singing songs by my sister, Glenda Shales. One of hers, It's Time to Build, was written as a result of listening to her dad preach from Haggai the prophet. So just special stuff. And I was thinking tonight, as we were singing, My Faith Looks Up to Thee, and I love that theme that you're running out there, brother. I've sung that song my whole life. And yet it means more to me today than it ever has. I don't know if I could really appreciate what that song was saying until the many experiences of my life. I want to tell you, this is the longest work I've done, the work with the Decker Prairie Church. I've been there for 14 years. And recently, my son has come back after going off to Florida College and working in Houston, getting married, having a couple of kids. Finally, we wooed him back to our neck of the woods, and he lives in Magnolia, where I do, and he's worshiping with us now, so that makes it even more special to have my youngest child there. But the work at Decker Prairie has been an incredibly rewarding work. To watch its growth from 80 people 14 years ago to what it is today, around 350, has just been an amazing thing to behold. It's hard to keep incorporating new people all the time. That's been one of the challenges of that work. It just seems like there's 5 to 10 new people to get to know and try to get connected to the group all the time. I've worked with two elders presently. Two more men were put up this morning in a couple of weeks. I'm sure they'll be serving with the two that we have. But the two elders that we have, I've worked with for 14 years. And nary a crossword with those two men, Robert Banning and Mike Moriarty. It's just been a blessing to be there among those folks. But I got to tell you, about 6 years ago, the greatest crisis of my life unfolded. My life crumbled before my very eyes. I remember sitting in my living room in great despondency one day, knowing that my marriage was over and that there was going to be no way to salvage it now. And I wondered what was going to happen next and what my life was going to look like down the road. I was blessed to be at Decker Prairie and to have amazing, awesome support. They walked with me through the valley. And I'll never forget that. When my parents passed rather suddenly in the summer of 2021, 8 of them got on a plane and flew down to Tampa, Florida to be at that funeral to encourage me. It's just been an awesome association. When I speak of my family, my wife Della and I, we were actually classmates at Florida College way back in the day, and we reconnected because of a similar life path, and we started dating in 2019 and were married later that year. So between us, we have 6 children and 5 grandchildren and a lot of things to tend to. So that's a little bit of my story, and that's why I say, My Faith Looks Up to You, Looks Up to Thee. It's been such a special song to me over the last several years when you don't know how things are going to work out, or if they're going to work out, or what it's all going to mean, when life's circumstances are what you never dreamed they were going to be. And so, I probably learned more in that period of my life to the present, because a lot of things unfolded after that. You know, I was married again and excited about this new journey with Della, and then this thing called COVID happened. Didn't see that coming. And I thought 2020 was going to be an awesome year, the year of spiritual vision, Christians seeing 2020. This is going to be great. And then by the summer, I'm going, this year's not been so great. And so a lot of things have happened since then, and Della's had some health struggles over the last couple of years. I'm experiencing one presently, but working through it, managing it. And so life throws you a lot of things you're not expecting. And when that happens, all I can say is you need to keep looking up and keep trusting no matter what. And so I want to talk to you tonight about the story that we're familiar with of Jesus walking on the water. And that takes me to the movie, TV series, or I don't know what you would call it. The Chosen. I don't know. Have you seen it? Some of you have. Some of you haven't. Some people won't watch a religious movie unless everything is straight out of the Bible. It's not that. There is some religious fiction involved where they're imagining how it could have been. There is filler to the story. But I do think their use of the text has been pretty good over three seasons. I mean, they're trying to stay true to the biblical record when they're actually talking about Bible events. And I've gone to the theater since that started happening. At the beginning of season three, episodes one and two, I saw at the theater. And then we went with some members, Philip and Lamar Schry, and their daughter, Fizzy. And Phillip's our celebrity at Decker Prairie, though he plays it down as much as he was on the Forged in Fire series, you know, where they make weapons, and he won his episode. And so he's our celebrity, but he's an awesome guy, humble guy, who cries every episode of The Chosen. And I don't cry every episode. In fact, when I was sitting next to him during episode 7 of season 3, I actually fell asleep. I'd gotten up really early that morning. It wasn't because episode 7 was bad. I just was really tired because I'd gotten up so early. So I revived for episode 8. And I got to tell you, the last show of this season, episode 8, blew me away. And I'll tell you what did it. It wasn't the feeding of the 5,000, which was spectacular. That's found in Matthew 14, where we're reading tonight. It wasn't even Jesus walking on the water, or Peter walking on the water to Jesus, which was also a spectacular scene that was well done in the movie. What really struck me the most was how they wrapped the entire episode around Psalm 77. And so they have at the very beginning Asaph and his men coming before King David to roll out Psalm 77. And I'm sitting there listening, and I have to admit, I'm telling on the preacher here, I did not know what psalm he was reading. I know where the Psalms of Asaph are, but I didn't know it was Psalm 77. I've got to admit, I've pretty much ignored Psalm 77. Now, not anymore. In my meeting in Kansas City 2 weeks ago, I was preaching on the Psalms, and one of them was Psalm 77 because of episode 8 of season 3 of The Chosen. Because I'm still to this day, it boggles my mind. Has there ever been a religious show or movie that has taken on Psalm 77? And I'm saying, uh-uh. It's never happened before. And the fact that they could see that and use that, because in many ways Psalm 77 is a very dark picture. In fact, I named the sermon, What's Wrong with God? as the psalmist is trying to figure out what's going on with the circumstances in my world that are totally upside down. It seems that God has utterly forsaken us, and yet I know He is there. And so he remembers God's deeds of old, the things God had done in the glorious past of Israel's history, and he asked God to come on behalf of Jacob again. So I love Psalm 77 now. And of course, all of that related to Peter and his wife Eden in the story. And this is part of not what you read in the Bible. Now, we know Peter was married, but we don't know anything about, you know, life with his wife or whether her name was Eden. But that's who she is in the story. It's a very compelling story. Peter's going through a lot of stuff. And I like how they presented that as it relates to Psalm 77. We're going to go through a lot of stuff in life, and perhaps what they had gone through is something that you have gone through. If not, it'll be something else. Peter experienced troubles and difficulties, but there was this glorious day where Peter walked on the water toward Jesus. I don't know how much you've reflected on this. I would say probably a lot. The story has been read a lot in your lifetime, most probably. But I want to read it with you and make some observations about this story. And immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side. He has just fed the 5,000. He would often go away by himself to meditate, to pray. He needed times of isolation, to walk with his Father. And so this would not be uncommon. And he sent the multitudes away. And after he sent the multitudes away, he went up to the mountain by himself to pray. And when it was evening, he was there alone. But the boat was already a good distance away from the land, battered by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now understand, Peter and Andrew, James and John were familiar with this sea. And yet, storms could whip up in a hurry. And it was very contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus came to them, walking on the sea. And at first, when the disciples saw him, they said, "It is a ghost!" And they cried out for fear. Well, I guess they believed in ghosts and were not really sure what they were seeing, but I'm pretty sure they've never seen anything like this on the sea before. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid." And then verse 28. "And Peter answered him and said, 'Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water.'" Now, he must have been some distance away because of the storm. He could not make out for certain if this was Jesus, even though he had identified himself. He said, "If it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And he said, "Come." And Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came toward Jesus. But seeing the wind, he became afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and took hold of him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind stopped. And those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, you are certainly God's son. This is not the same story as Mark would tell of the time that Jesus is asleep in the boat. And the storm was raging, and Jesus would come and again upbraid them for the fact that they were so little of faith. And he would calm the storm, and the sea was still. And again, this reaction of the disciples, this is impressive, this is incredible. And so, I want to talk to you about this day that Peter walked on the water. I know that there are some negative things in this story, but I want you to think about this from the perspective of the disciples, and Peter in particular. What did it take for Peter to even make this request? He had never walked on water before. I mean, he knows Jesus is a great miracle worker and that he had seen some awesome things like the feeding of the 5,000 earlier, which was incredible. And now Jesus is coming to them. He assumes it's him. If it is you, and he says, come. And so over the side of the boat he goes. I would like to know how that process unfolded, how long it took him to get over the side of the boat, and how long he walked on the water. Can you imagine those first few steps? As a little kid, I always thought, I'd like to try that. I'd like to walk on the water for a while. That's really cool, because every time I've tried it, I've gone straight down under. It hasn't worked for me. He actually walked on the water for a ways. And then he started looking at the storm around him, and he began to sink. And so as we look at the negatives, did he become afraid? Check. Did he have faith that wavered? That's a check. Did he take his eyes off the Lord? Again, a check. And did he sink? Yes, Peter sunk. I mean, I think I preach another sermon about Peter. I have a lot of sermons about Peter. My son Brett loves Peter. He loves all things Peter. And so I preach sermons about Peter for him. And so one of the sermons I have, the first point is Peter sinks. It rhymes with Peter stinks. And I think sometimes that we sort of think that about Peter because of all of his blunders. I mean, if you think about Peter, what's one of the first things that comes to your mind? Lots of blunders. Not just this, but telling the Lord, oh, this is not going to be the case. You're not going to die in this way. And he has to be told by the Lord, get behind me, Satan. You know, that's a real shocker when you are told that by the master teacher. Get behind me, Satan. And then there's the threefold denial. And then all that unfolds after the resurrection, where three times Jesus is going to say to Peter, do you love me? And he has to affirm it three times. Oh, but he's done, right? After the resurrection, no, there's the matter of the Gentiles, and he gets carried away with the Jews. Even Barnabas gets wrapped up in all of that, according to Galatians chapter 2. And he has to be withstood to the face by the Johnny-come-lately apostle who had persecuted Christians, the apostle Paul. You think about how humbling that is, that Paul has to withstand you to the face for your behavior, and to Peter's credit, though I don't know what his reaction was. Paul doesn't talk about it in Galatians chapter 2. It's the only place that story is told. But I'm going to assume, correctly so, that Peter responded humbly to that. And he corrected his course. He would end up writing 1st and 2nd Peter. His apostleship was not over at that point, despite that pretty massive blunder in Galatians chapter 2. So when we look at this incident and the four questions that have been raised and all the check boxes, Peter failed. Now, I do want to emphasize verse 32 again. And when they got into the boat, the wind stopped. Again, Jesus is showing his power over everything. He who created everything has power over nature. But as I reflect on Peter in the story, yes, he is admonished by the Lord. Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? But what about the positives of this story? What did he do when he got in trouble? What do you do when you get in trouble? When you find yourself walking not in a way that is consistent with the righteousness of God, as we talked about this morning from the Sermon on the Mount, what is your response? Do you cry out to the Lord? God, be merciful to me, the sinner. As the publican prayed, the one who went down to his house justified, he went to the right source to fix his problem. He cried out to the Lord to save. And I would make this observation. We tend to talk about all the failures Peter made, but I don't see James and John and Andrew and the other apostles saying, Lord, if it's you, bid me to come out on the water. They all just sat in the boat, were spectators. Peter actually got out of the boat. He believed that Jesus could make him walk on the water. And so I ask, where was the 11 who stayed in the boat? We're very critical of Peter because he sunk, because he was looking around at the wind and the waves, and he took his eyes off the Lord. But where are the 11? We don't talk about them. And so I would raise this thought to you about Peter's example in Matthew 14. Is it time for you to take God by the hand and go for a walk? Walking with God. And some may indeed criticize you because it's not perfect. And the criticism may well come from those who are still in the boat. This is a quote from a former president, Teddy Roosevelt. Perhaps you've heard it before. He said, it is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again. Because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the great deeds? Who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory or defeat. I think Teddy Roosevelt well summarizes the person of Peter. Yes, he was impetuous. Yes, he often spoke without realizing what he was saying, like he did at the Transfiguration. He would ask the question that the other disciples were afraid to ask, that was on their minds as well. And so we tend to look at Peter with a great deal of criticism. I think there is a place to observe the errors of people in Scripture who were numbered among the righteous. But sometimes I hear things about people like Peter and people like David
that are just really, really negative. I think we
somewhat enjoy perhaps taking pot shots at these men, question their spirituality, even some of the judges like Jephthah and Samson. We can focus on the negatives if we want to, but listen, Jephthah and Samson's names are mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11. There must be a reason why their names were put in there. That's the New Testament. And David is styled in the New Testament in Acts 13, the man after my heart who will do all my will. Yes, there are blips on the radar screen, but I want you to think about this. What if everything you've ever done, everything you've ever thought or said was open season to be put in God's book? Your entire history to this point was there for God to use and include in the written record. Would you want some of that stuff in there? I wouldn't. And yet they were the souls who lived in that time, whose lives could be recorded. Instead of being so negative about their failures, let's look at more positive things about these characters, that they did fail and they did stumble, but they rectified the course, just as we're called to do. Why do we get on our high horse and almost get self-righteous about it?
I preached a sermon about David in a meeting for a number of years
called, "You Are the Man." Nathan coming into his presence, saying that to the king. And I talked about this very idea. And lo and behold, his sister walks out and she just looks at me and says, "I'll never get over what David did." I thought, you missed the whole point of the sermon. First of all, he's not ordinary Joe. He's a king. I'll tell you, when you're a king of a country, king of a nation, there's some entitlement that goes with that, that David went a little overboard with. I don't know what it's like to be king, do you? And so you sort of get this mentality that things are there to serve you. And David fell into some of that. And he made a terrible mistake. And he paid a terrible price for what he did to Uriah and Bathsheba. But that was not characteristic. That was a season, a short season in David's life. That was not the total picture. And Peter's failures, as numerous as they seem as we look into the biblical account, some of these other guys, I mean, we're probably just fortunate that we don't know more about them. You know, some of the 12, we just don't know a lot about them. They had their blunders too, and of course there was Judas who made the ultimate blunder and who went to his own place. But I think sometimes we're really hard on those who fail, who are leaders in particular. So I want to make a few closing remarks about this story, a few admonitions, and one is this, that leadership can have its costs. Some people will not accept a position of leadership among the Lord's people because of the costs involved. And I can just tell you from having served with godly men and worked with godly men who were elders, I've seen what they have gone through. I've seen the unjust criticism. Sometimes the criticism is valid. I'm not saying it isn't. But I have seen them put through the ringer over the silliest of stuff. And so I preach this point a lot because it's true of them. It's true of preachers. I mean, we're not above and beyond criticism. If you talk as much as I do, you're going to mess it up somewhere. Leadership can have its cost, but the rewards, and this was true for Peter, the rewards far outweigh the costs. And so in whatever sphere that you can serve and lead among God's people, I encourage you to do it. There will always be those who pick you apart. Envy, unfortunately, is something that can run rampant in the hearts of individuals. It was the reason why Jesus was delivered to death, because he had something that they were jealous of.
the attention, the following. The masses were drawn to him. And so that's going to be the case among those who lead. And it doesn't take very many people. We'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow night. To create quite a stir and quite controversial things. And I would say this, no one can claim freedom from failure. Before I get too hard on Peter, who was a great disciple of our Lord, everybody fumbles from time to time. No one can claim that I've been absolutely free from misconduct even since I became a Christian. You would think at the point that we become Christians that we would know better and never stumble again. That's just not the case. The third observation that I would make, and this is very important, is that faith is not a constant and that it can fluctuate. It can waver. And we just need to keep striving. Notice the faith that it took for Peter to get over the side of the boat and to start walking toward Jesus. And it can happen just that fast. Faith one moment, doubt the next. Faith is not a constant. But isn't it awesome in this story? Jesus did not let him just sink. Told you, you know. You've really messed it up now, Peter. Good luck. Hope you get back to the boat. He said, Lord, save me. And the Lord could have said, you've messed up now. I'm not going to do that. But instead, he reaches down and grabs him. Yes, the rebuke comes, but he saves him first. So is our high priest. He comes to us. He sympathizes with our weakness, the Hebrew writer says. He comes to the aid of the tempted. He is our faithful and merciful high priest, which is what the whole book of Hebrews is about. He understands our condition. He understands our struggles with faith at times. And our high priest sympathizes with our struggle. And he comes to the end of that message in Hebrews chapter 10 and says, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. You have need of endurance, so that when you've done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. And I would tell you this, where did Peter's problems begin? When he took his eyes off Jesus. But seeing the wind, he became afraid and began to sink. Looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. That's what the Hebrew writer would go on to say in Hebrews chapter 12, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, and he sat down at the right hand of God. And those who are in the boat, when they see Jesus for who he is, you are certainly God's son. Are you ever afraid? Peter was afraid. In fact, there was a lot of fear going on in the story. I don't know if you noticed that. Seems to be that's the backdrop of the entire miracle that unfolds. The disciples were afraid. Sometimes fear is an emotion. It's a response that we have to certain stimuli. It's not wrong to look at this. This is a scary situation. Like if all of a sudden there's a copperhead ready to strike you. How did I get here? You know, I actually was leaving one of our members' homes several years ago, and I just opened the front door and walked out, headed toward the car, and I looked back, and the owner of the house, he's just laughing. I said, what's so funny, Ted? And he said, you just stepped right over a copperhead who was on the mat at the front door. And I said, I never saw him. I was that close to my worst fear, being bit by a snake. One of our members recently was playing golf. I play golf. He got bit by a snake. Thankfully, it wasn't poisonous. Nightmare of nightmares. Situations unfold and fear happens. Do you think there were any believers afraid of COVID? Do you think anybody was afraid? About what if I get that? And now if I ask how many of you had it, a lot of hands would go up. What if I get that? Could I die? Well, yeah, you could. But of those things that we're afraid of, and when our response is fear, I would have you know that trust conquers fear. In Psalm 31, another psalm I love to preach about, David's going through a rough time. It is the psalm that Jesus quotes on the cross when he says, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." Jesus is going through a rough time. He's dying on the cross. It's almost over. "Thou hast ransomed me, O God of truth. Into thy hands I commit my spirit." And so David is groaning. He is languishing in this psalm. And Jesus, by quoting it, is saying, you know what David's feeling back in Psalm 31? Put a turbocharge on it. That's what I'm experiencing here. There's an interesting verse in Psalm 31, about verse 15, where it says, "My times are in your hand." That sort of connects me back to my first lesson this morning in Psalm 139. My times are in your hand. I don't know how many more days I have, how many more years I have, but I tell you, I'm going to be here as long as the Lord has plans for me here. Well, how long is that? I don't know. Could it be possible that I could die what we call an untimely death? Josiah did. When it was time, God was done with Josiah as king. He took him home. Interesting departure for Josiah. Probably never would have imagined it. Hezekiah was not an old man when he died. He was given 15 more years of life because he asked for it. I don't know the future. I don't know what tomorrow holds. But I know this: if I walk by faith, my times are in his hand. And that kind of trust will conquer fear. You need that kind of trust in the Lord. And Zion's call is for you to respond while there's time and opportunity. Let's stand.